Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Straight Up with your host, Chris Martinson, here, and it is Saturday, June 15th, 2019. And today, I'm going to be going through a piece that went out, a written piece called Waiting for the Black Swan, subtitle, War with Iran Would Be, Not Could Be, the Beginning of the End. And the purpose of this piece, of course, there were some tanker attacks recently, and actually a pair of them, first episode last month, and then another on Thursday of this past week. And this has the potential, obviously, to go kinetic, spill over, become larger, all of that. And so this piece is explaining and talking about really what the impact of that would be. But again, as is usual, what we're going to do is we're going to widen the lens up, because we have to understand oil in the larger context of really where we are as a species in terms of our economy. I think we're being led badly astray by all these economists who are looking through their own tiny, dogmatic, narrow windows of understanding, and they don't have this biophysical economics view, which says, actually, everything you think you know is a subset of the resources we get from the natural world. They have it upside down. So this is a piece that explores really why I think a war with Iran would be the black swan event, and I'll explain what those are in just a minute, that black swan event that when it kicks off, it catches most people really pretty badly by surprise. So in this piece, I say there are two more tankers were attacked near the Strait of Hormuz on Thursday morning. That was 6/13/19, June 13th, in the Gulf of Oman, and that was right near the Strait of Hormuz. And if hostilities advance from here, we could be facing a black swan event. Again, I'll talk about what that means in just a second. One that changes everything and divides the world into a before and an after period. And a lot of us are waiting for something to happen. We know there are too many unsustainable trends and practices running, and we fall, I do, many of us fall into this camp of, well, let's just rip the Band-Aid off. And some, like myself, have lost faith in the political leadership and institutions, that includes corporations, things like that, colleges, everything, and doubt that they retain any capacity to attend to anything more than their own selfish interests, let alone manage the difficult tasks ahead, rooted as they are in systems theory and managing complexity. So, let's get on with it already. Bring it on. Black swans are welcome to those who feel a swift kick in the behind. Sometimes is exactly what's needed to begin setting things straight. Now, like many, I'm also conflicted, because I also know that getting onto a new path is going to be disruptive and probably quite economically and financially painful for a lot of people, maybe everyone, myself included. So hoping for something to break and hoping nothing breaks hang in an uneasy balance for many people. Luckily, my hopes and wishes have nothing to do with what's going to happen or when. I might as well be performing a secret hand ritual before the TV in my living room to ensure that my team's basketball free throw goes in. The dry tinder of the next bonfire was laid down over many years and decades, and it will catch fire when it does, no matter how much denial or how many superstitious practices we employ. When this current period of insane monetary policy, polarizing politics, and ecological destruction suddenly breaks for the worse, is unknowable. Is this going to break when it does? I hope that's not for 10 years, and I kind of hope that's tomorrow. True ambivalence. So now we go into this section called Black Swans. A Black Swan event is a term coined by Nassim Taleb, which has three characteristics. One, it's unpredictable. Two, it has a massive impact. And three, afterwards, everyone comes up with an explanation for it. There's an honorary fourth characteristic I'd like to apply, which is that virtually no experts will have seen it coming. Black swan events can be both positive and negative. So here's an example of an expert missing something positive. Paul Krugman in 1998 said, quote, by 2005 or so, it will become clear that the internet's impact on the economy has been no greater than the fax machines, end quote. Well, I think it's safe to say Paul Krugman got that one just a tiny bit wrong. The genesis of the term black swan comes from the former Western belief that all swans were white. 100% of their experience with swans confirmed that they were all white in color. However, in 1697, the Dutch explorer Willem de Flaming made it to Australia and discovered black swans. Once a black swan is seen, or a black swan event occurs, everything falls into a before versus an after category. Before, there were no black swans. Now you have to include the idea that a black swan is possible because you've seen one. When it comes to massive history-altering events, while they may be explained in retrospect by earnest historians as having been due to some specific thing, they usually had plenty of dry tinder lying about, waiting for a spark. Many of us learned that World War I was caused by an archduke being shot. Now, in truth, if there hadn't been many prior years of feuding and bad politics and terrible economic policies, worse communications, absolutely nothing more than an elaborate state funeral would have probably resulted from the archduke being shot. Afterwards, everyone assigned a simple explanation to a complex situation to describe how World War I got started, because that's what people do. Well, today there's a similar pile of dry tinder all laying about just waiting for a spark. There's too much debt, worsening geopolitics, terrible press and social media stripping away necessary context as a matter of habitual practice, stovepiped information and expertise, and increasingly alarming, if not terrifying, signals from the natural world that the sort of economic growth upon which everything is based can't continue. It seems as if, to me, the world is waiting for something, a black swan to arrive, carrying a bright coal burning in its beak. When that time comes, virtually none of the experts on TV or at the think tanks will have seen it coming. Nearly everyone will be surprised at the impact, and few will grasp the complexity surrounding how all that dry tinder came to be laying about in the first place. That is, they're going to go for the simplistic explanation, right? We will all suffer the consequences to varying degrees, depending on our financial, physical, and emotional preparations, as well as due to luck and random misfortune, right? Where you happen to be living and how things fall and break is unpredictable, so you might get lucky, you might not. Now, let's turn our attention to the Strait of Hormuz. That's that little body of water through which 30% of all ship-bound exported oil passes on a daily basis, and global debts. So let's connect a couple of dots here. I think they have the potential to form the black swan event that changes everything. The first is the massive pile of debt and impossible-to-meet IOUs that the world's central banks have enabled. Not all on their own. Obviously, you needed willing politicians and a gullible public, but still, the central banks enabled that as a matter of policy, active policy. The more debt you're carrying as a nation, company, or individual, the better things have to go for you financially and or economically. That is, debt makes you more vulnerable to shocks. The world has never been more deeply in debt, nor has it ever been more deeply in underfunded IOUs in the form of pension and entitlement promises that probably can't be met, right? So I have a chart here. I'm talking about the financial tinder that's waiting for a spark. We can see it, at least, in just global debt. Again, not liabilities. This is a chart of just global debt. It comes from Financial Times, and it shows that the big increase in debt from 2008, from the onset of the great financial crisis, as it's now being called, to today, has been taken on by government and non-financial corporates. Non-financial corporates is everybody except the banks and the financial institutions, right? So that would be all the, like, Apple is a non-financial corporate, right? So Apple's got a lot of debt, has a lot of cash. When you look at that, we see that the big explosion in debt on this chart has been in governments. Obviously, they're trying to stimulate and spend their way past a recession, and those non-financial corporates. The nearly $100 trillion increase in global debt since the beginning of the great financial crisis is an unprecedented act. And it was kind of an act of faith, one rooted in the idea that global GDP growth would come along and save the day, or at least rationalize, if not justify, these new massive piles of debt. In truth, this love affair with debt can be traced back to August 15th, 1971, when the world abandoned the gold standard in favor of the idea that debts themselves could be the backing for debt. Really cool idea. I think that when we talk about the large bubbles that are about to burst, the everything bubble, I don't ascribe to the idea that there was a stock bubble in 2000, a housing bubble in 2007, and that today we have a different sort of a bubble. To me, those are all sub-bubbles on top of the larger one that began all the way back in the 70s. With this idea, crazy as it is, mathematically inane as it is, that we can grow our debts, that is, our claims on the future, at a far faster compounding rate. That's an exponential compounding rate. We can grow our debts at a faster exponential compounding rate than the economy itself. Now, the economy is the real stuff. That's the stuff you want to lay the claims on. How can you make the claims grow faster than the stuff? Well, you can't, right? Secondarily, you also have a problem if the stuff itself can't grow forever because it's a finite planet, right? Those are the core ideas of the Crash Course. If you haven't seen it, or watched it or listened to it, I would invite you to go check out the Crash Course. If you want the shortest version, that's the Accelerated Crash Course. Just if you need to, if you can't find it at the website, Google Martinson Accelerated Crash Course. Boom. Watch that thing. 53 minutes will probably change how you see the world. Now, it should be noted that virtually zero expert economists are publicly worried about the enormous rise in debts. And if they were, they wouldn't be publicly known experts because nobody would invite these experts to speak about their ideas. Nobody wants to hear about this. Yeah, as bad as the debts are, though, the unfunded liabilities, the IOUs in this story, they are 2 times to 4 times larger than the debts themselves, depending on the country. In the U.S., the entire collective pile, debts plus IOUs, worked out to a staggering 1,100% of GDP in 2017. Now that's 300% debt to GDP for debt itself, and another 800% compared to GDP for the underfunded liabilities. Notice that the debt part in this above chart, again, we're looking at a chart here, lots of brightly colored, beautiful stacking things for trending basically upwards from left to right. The debt part in the above chart circled in orange is really, it's as I mentioned, it's the minor part of the story. It's the 300% part of the story, even though it that smaller portion, the debt usually receives most of the press, right? The larger part is that 800% part just sitting there, very rarely talked about because, of course, kind of depressing. Like, you can't even imagine how you're going to pay the debts back. The IOUs are an even harder story to talk about, so we don't talk about it. Very human sort of characteristic there. Well, the only way to rationalize or justify such a pile of IOUs and debts is rapid economic growth. And the only way to get that? Cheap and plentiful oil. Well, energy, but I'm going to talk about oil here for a second. Because oil is really the key to this story. It really is. It still is. I'm going to stay on that. That's my deal. We have to understand oil in this story. Okay, so this now brings us back to the recent spate of tanker attacks near the Strait of Hormuz, through which, as I mentioned, some 30% of all exported oil flows on a daily basis. Oil's role in our economic engine is enormously underappreciated by the usual economic experts out there. To them, energy is this substance that shows up whenever needed. They have no deeper understanding than that. And to me, energy is the master resource without which no other activities are even possible. You show me anything that you buy, that you do, or consume and I'll show you how oil was an essential precursor somewhere in the long line of things that were required to bring you that thing that you bought, engaged in whatever activity it was, or the thing you consumed. It's as simple as this. The ever-increasing piles of debt and IOUs are an explicit call for a larger future economy. So, you want more economy, you say? Great, then you're going to use more energy. In particular, do you want more global economy with everything shipped hither and yon in 30,000-mile-long supply chains? Well, then you're going to use more energy and more oil specifically. And more than 50 years of data says so, with barely any departure in that data. So now I have a chart that's showing how GDP, that's the economy, and energy are tightly coupled. Not a hard chart to explain to you because we have GDP up the y-axis and we got world energy consumption across the x-axis. This is a great chart that's coming from Ugo Bardi of CassandraLegacy.blogspot.com. Ugo does great work on this. He's drawing data from BP and the World Bank. And here's why this chart's so easy to explain to you. It's a simple straight line going from left to right. So as world GDP is going up the y-axis, you're seeing world energy consumption go up in lockstep, so that you get a straight line. It's not like the scatter plot and, you know, we sort of have to squint at it. This is as straight a line as you want. I love this chart. I love it because this is the tightest economic data chart I've got. It's the correlation and causation is all like wrapped and landed into one tiny spot. If you want more GDP, this chart is saying, you're going to burn more energy. And here's the deal, folks. You don't just need energy. You need net surplus energy. That is, after you're done investing energy to get energy, what's left over? Well, that's the stuff you get to use to make your economy grow. Right? So we might think of the energy that's consumed out there as having two components. One is a sustaining component. That's the energy you have to pull out of the ground in order to get more energy out of the ground, right? Because that's what we're doing. We're basically harvesting, extracting, mining fossil fuel energy, hundreds of millions of years of ancient sunlight, all compressed and collapsed, waiting to be found and exploited by some species. Hey, happen to be humans, and we're going to burn through it all in roughly 200 years. So let's say 400 million years of accumulation and 200 years of just burning through it. Now, that's the stuff. That sustaining portion is the part of the energy you need to get more energy, right? So let's imagine we want to get more coal out of the ground. Well, you need big shovels, steam shovels equivalent, or, you know, diesel shovels. You need trucks, big giant diesel trucks. You need to make the trucks, you need to fuel them, all of that stuff. So it's pretty clear that there's a certain amount of energy required to make sure that the people, the equipment, the fuel all shows up at the coal mine so that you can even get the coal out. Now, let's, for example, imagine it takes one unit to get 10 units of coal worth of energy out. So we were saying then that we're having a 1 to 10 return, or we spend one and then we have 9 left over to use. However you want to think about that. But there's the sustaining portion of the energy consumption is what we need to do to just get that energy out of the ground. And then there's a second portion, which is the waste heat that happens. No matter how well you build an engine, no matter how well you build the coal-fired boiler system at your electrical generating plant, it turns out that you're going to just, a bunch of the energy that's in that energy to begin with turns into waste heat. Nothing happens. Just it's waste heat. Off it goes, radiating out into the air and hopefully off into space eventually. The third portion is the portion that we get to use. Now, that's the surplus. That's the net in this story. That's the stuff you actually get to do something with. And that's the part that the economy depends on. All right. So this chart I'm talking about really just shows that world energy use is tightly coupled with economic growth. More economy equals more energy consumed. And it's linear, very easy to grasp. Yet most economic experts don't even bother themselves with such information. I think because it violates their dogmatic views about the necessary imperative for endless growth, which means this information would violate literally everything they learned, know, and believe, and most importantly, draw a paycheck from. So mostly they don't go there. They instead falsely believe that economic growth makes energy resources become available. But they have it backwards. It's exactly the other way around. Energy resources allow economic growth to occur. Most of these economists, they believe that infinite growth on a finite planet is not only possible, but it's a good thing, despite virtually mountains of increasingly dismal ecological and resource data to the contrary. Now, oil is a weird substance economically. If there's even a few percent too much coming out of the ground, that is an excess of supply compared to demand, the price plummets. And if there's even a slight shortage, on the other hand, too little supply coming out compared to demand, prices move sharply higher. Now, given the importance of oil, however, we should not be focused merely on its price, although that's important, but also its availability. Yes, shortages in availability will lead to price spikes, and those price spikes will crush over-indebted countries, companies, and individuals alike. But shortages will, by necessity, also lead to less economic activity. Remember, because the economy and energy are linked that way. So the amount actually counts in this story. Now, exactly how all that plays out is entirely unknowable. And welcome to complexity theory, which states that the behaviors of complex systems cannot be predicted. They can be observed. And what actually happens when you observe a complex system undergoing a change, what actually happens are called emergent behaviors. If a war with Iran breaks out and the Strait of Hormuz gets closed down for any length of time, say more than a month, there will be a shortage of oil that will lead to a price spike and a physical shortage of oil as well. We need to keep that in mind. Now, how all that plays out in a world groaning under the weight of too much debt is thoroughly unknowable. But it won't be favorable, right? We can get the direction of it. We just don't know the details. And it won't be pretty or desired by anybody, myself included. I actually wish that we'd backed up in the 70s if we could rewind the story, go back. We had an opportunity. We had all the data, as I've put on pieces at my site. Admiral Hyman Rickover talked about all this stuff in 1956. We had deep understandings of this in the 60s. We had Jimmy Carter talking about all this in the 70s. It's just kind of since we went off the gold standard, we went down this path of saying, nah, not going to look at any of that stuff, right? So here's the deal. What happens? What actually emerges? What happens to a complex, global, integrated, just-in-time delivery system is unknowable. Again, it won't be pretty. We'll just have to watch as supply chain disruptions spread through a complex universe of derivatives and 12% zombie companies, cov-lite loans, $4 trillion of emerging market dollar-denominated debt, already astonishing fiscal deficits, underfunded pensions, all the rest, right? We'll just have to watch and see what emerges. Now, with the new attacks on two more oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman and the U.S.'s immediate blaming of Iran, even before the evidence came in, there's a much higher than acceptable risk of a very damaging war breaking out that will close the Strait of Hormuz. My conclusion here is this. Look, the world is sitting on an enormous pile of debts and related IOUs. Hold that. That's on one hand. One that could easily catch fire and burn with the slightest provocation, the smallest spark, right? It's just ready to go. While the central banks can print money, create the easiest financial conditions in decades, if not lifetimes, and they certainly can constantly intervene in both word and deed in every financial market, which they do, the one thing they cannot do, well, not the one thing, there's many things they can't do, but one thing they cannot do is print up more oil. If the Strait of Hormuz gets shut down for any length of time, that's going to be a black swan event. It will be unforeseen, will have a huge impact, and afterwards people will try and explain the resulting complexities in simplistic ways. My advice is you need to have a plan in place for what you're going to do if or when that happens. Everyone does. You don't want to have to develop a plan on the fly. You want to know what you're going to do and what your plan is, and you should have many of these preparations in place before anything happens. That's kind of the first rule of preparing. Do it before everyone else is, and not mid-crisis, of course. Already we're seeing signs that oil traffic through the Strait of Hormuz has slowed a little bit, perhaps to allow the insurance risks to be sorted out. It's a guess. It's reasonable to suggest that it will take time to assess the actual risks and apply new insurance policies and new insurance rates. In the meantime, some ships are just going to sit anchored or at port while this all gets sorted out. An oil price and supply shock is exactly the sort of black swan event that will take nearly everyone by surprise, particularly because the narrative has been very one-sided and it's been one of shale-fueled abundance for so long now that practically nobody's thinking about the flip side of that story, which is a massive supply shortfall. Now, after the fact, long after the damage has been done and the dust has settled, historians may look back and say, you know, it was that one Chinese C-308 variant missile from the shores of Iran striking and sinking the Saudi-flagged VLCC, the Very Large Crude Container, the Layla, in the center of the outbound shipping channel of the Strait of Hormuz that was what caused everything that followed. That was the thing. That was the Archduke getting shot. Everything was a consequence of that. Well, listen, while that event may have happened, that explanation won't be entirely accurate. Because without an entire bonfire-sized pile of ultra-dry debt tinder laying about, and without decades of ill will and nefarious actions, the missile wouldn't have flown in the first place, and the bonfire wouldn't have raged quite so fiercely. Sometimes an archduke is just an archduke. And insufficient to cause tens of millions of needless deaths in a war nobody can quite explain. Other times, an archduke is all that and more. The U.S. press in particular loves to act as if these things all, they just happen, context-free, in a vacuum. Iranians are unpredictable and weird. As if a half a century of U.S. activity in the region never occurred. Look, nothing ever happens in a vacuum. There's always context. And when it comes to Iran, there's plenty. Many decades of interference and what we might call blunt diplomacy. So keep your eyes on the Strait of Hormuz, have your preparations and a plan in place before anything goes further off the rails. That's my advice here. There's already an economic slowdown occurring, which will very quickly morph into a serious recession if when an oil shock occurs. This third and most ill-advised credit bubble of them all, much worse than the one in 2000, much worse than the one in 2008. This one, most ill-advised of them all. Let's hope we don't do a fourth, because they just get worse and worse. Look, it's already lasted for far too long. Every bubble is in search of a pin or a black swan. An oil shock would be like an entire flock of black swans against which the central banks would be powerless. Why? Because you can't print oil. It's that simple. Will this simply be the end of the everything bubble, or will this mark the end of the grand credit experiment that started back in 1971? The former will be very painful. The latter will change everything forever for everyone. That's the end of this piece, which is the public version. It's part one of this story. We have a part two, which is titled What Happens When War Meets Recession. Subtitle, I would call this A Flock of Black Swans. So there, in part two, we discuss the tanker attacks, the many recession indicators that we're tracking right now, how those are stacking up. Listen, people, it's a question of if, not if, but when. And are you prepared? Thank you for listening.